At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is Tuesday and Tom Brady has officially retired. I suppose we could devote the entire podcast to discussing that. Dana Milbank. Dana Milbank joins me, nationally syndicated columnist for the Washington Post. By the way, thanks for coming back on the podcast.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Charlie.
Okay, so I'm a Green Bay Packer fan, but I think that there's no real way to argue that Tom Brady's not the greatest of all time. It pains me to say it. I want to not like the guy, but you can't make the case unless you want to.
No, the only risk here is that just because he's confirmed his retirement doesn't mean that he will in fact be retired tomorrow or the next day or the day after that. So he may have future seasons yet to disprove the thesis. But
well, that's true. Well, yeah. You know, we went through that with the whole Brett Favre on again, off again, tearfully and showing up someplace else.
Right,
but
right.
I don't know. It's been a wild and crazy ride, and he retires at the end of arguably what's so far been the most exciting playoff football pretty much ever. Are you a football fan?
Well, I grew up a New York Jets fan, and that it might have poisoned me against the whole thing. And of course, you know, living in Washington, you have the very difficult position of wanting to root for the Washington football team, but against its owner. So I've been wrestling with that a great deal. So no, it's really quite difficult.
So one of our listeners just sent me a quote that I probably should have used in my newsletter today, my palate cleanser newsletter today about Thomas Massie's latest incredibly stupid tweet. Somebody sent me Hanlon's razor, which is, of course, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good reminder. I'm talking about Thomas Massie, the crazy Republican from Kentucky who tweeted out what he thought was a Voltaire quote. You know, I mean, this is so good. You mustn't question Fauci, for he is science. And then he has this Voltaire quote alleged: to learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize. Okay. And then there's this big hand coming down on, you know, free thinking Joe Rogan podcast listeners or something like that. Well, you can't make this up. As you know, it's not Voltaire. Voltaire never said anything like this. The quote actually comes from this guy named Kevin Strum, who's a neo-Nazi who pleaded guilty in 2008 to possession of child pornography. So it's this trifecta of just pure awfulness. And he was referring to the Jews and everything. So Thomas Massie.
Fabulous. Because usually these quotes are, you know, mistakenly attributed either to Martin Luther King or Oscar Wilde or Mark Twain. But now to go straight to the Nazis, that's brilliant.
Well, it is. And, you know, you can just sort of see Thomas Massie sitting around, you know, who once bragged about being the craziest son of a bitch on the ballot, going, okay, I'm going to show my education by quoting the French philosopher Voltaire, and he ends up with a Nazi pedophile.
That is excellent. He and his colleagues have made a career sort of misquoting the framers and the founders. So, but this is a new element. I'm glad you've highlighted it.
And the fun part, of course, is that he hasn't taken it down yet.
He probably thinks Voltaire is a neo-Nazi.
Well, that's right. And look, you just can't apologize these days, right? And you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's going to come in and defend him, and he's probably going to raise money
about all this.
But I feel the need to search out these nuggets these days, because otherwise your head would explode. So speaking of that, before we get into whole, you know, the what we're learning about the Trump coup, the former president just put out a statement a few minutes ago calling on the January 6th committee to investigate Mike Pence. So,
I'm sure they'll take that one right up.
So let's back into that, though. I loved your piece about the blizzard of snowflakes in the red states. Your latest column, your column from Friday in the Post, discusses the whole thought police problem, which, since we're talking about neo-Nazis and Nazis and everything, talking about this rural county in Tennessee that last week banned Mouse, the Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel by Art Spiegelman, which teaches kids about the Holocaust by portraying Jews as mice and Nazis as cats. And it was apparently, that was not the disturbing part for the school board folks in Tennessee. That wasn't it. There were some naughty words.
Yes, it was the naughty words, and I think there was some mouse nudity or something else that they found objectionable. So this may be another case of somebody bumbling into something rather than doing it out of malice. But I thought it was terrific that now they're afraid of cats and mice. And, you know, it was almost exactly 100 years ago that Tennessee had the problem with Darwin's monkeys. So I pointed out that it does not appear that the volunteer state is evolving. We seem to be right back where we were 100 years ago. We're now talking about banning books. But I suppose it's progress. Banning mice instead of monkeys.
As you point out, and this is the state that once celebrated Davy Crockett, now is afraid of a cartoon mouse exposing kids to, you know, bad language. I mean, you really can't get more snowflakey than that, right?
Yeah, it's tragic. So, but you know what's going to happen now. You're going to be accused of being an elitist for pointing out that the gentleman from Kentucky has gotten Voltaire wrong.
Right.
And I'm going to be exposed as an elitist for pointing out that Tennessee has been a little bit backward of late on the whole evolution thing.
Yeah, with apologies to David French, who actually lives there. I think in this county, you might be considered an elitist because you've actually read a book. So I'm okay. Here we go.
We're in trouble.
But I mean, there have been these book bans. You know, Toni Morrison's been banned in St. Louis. Margaret Atwood, the Handmaid's Tale, was banned in a suburb of Wichita. Mm-hmm. Appropriately enough, as well as other books. So you did a little research on this. I mean, how widespread is this? We get the anecdotes, but how serious is this as a problem?
Well, so a couple of points on that. So I talked to the American Library Association. They counted between 300 and 400 in just 3 months. They didn't have December yet, so it was September, October, November of last year. That is roughly the same amount from an entire year in 2019. 2020 is kind of skewed because of the pandemic and schools were closed. So we're now at the four times the pace of these book bannings or attempts at banning. And at the same time, we've got 10 states now. Some states have done more than one law. So there's 12 of these, you know, sort of gag laws or memory laws saying you may not teach history in thus and such a way. And, you know, generally it's or often it's phrased as if it makes any student feel uncomfortable, which I think can be read as any white student feeling uncomfortable. So and then, you know, in a state like Virginia, where the governor can't get that through the legislature, he's instead got a hotline saying, you know, call and report on a teacher if they're saying anything divisive. So these things are much more dangerous than one isolated rural county banning one book from the library, because how many people does that affect? But there's this, you know, this crazy chilling effect going on. I mean, if you're a teacher, you're just going to stay away from any, you know, why would you discuss slavery? Why would you discuss civil rights? You're just, you know, asking for...
Well, especially with there's a tip line, you know, and that's the... As we enter into Black History Month, if you are a teacher, you really do have to sit down and go, okay, what can I say about Reconstruction?
Right.
You know, how much of the history just sort of has to be rah rah, And what about the ugly parts? What if telling some of the ugly parts makes people feel uncomfortable? Now, this is the point that I really liked that you made, though, that it feels like 5 minutes ago that people on the right were howling about ultra-sensitive snowflakes and cancel culture when woke activities.
Let's be honest, they weren't entirely wrong.
No,
about that.
Not at all.
The Confederate statues are one thing, but you know, people were going after books as well. You know, I think the sort of woke movement on the left wanted to, there were movements, and I think there still are, you know, to get rid of To Kill a Mockingbird or something.
Yeah,
and that goes too far. But what's happened now is, you know, in the name of, you know, stopping these snowflakes on the left, it's a monstrous, you know, New England sized nor'easter that is, you know, much worse than the problem it purported to be solving, because now you've got this much more dramatic chilling effect. So I've actually, because as you mentioned, it's Black History Month, I've decided, well, what do they want people to teach? So I'm going back to the 1970s textbook from Virginia, and I'm going to just excerpt it as much as I can about the benevolent master.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, but I mean, this isn't the 1880s. This was the 1970s when this was being taught. So, I suppose if the goal is not to make any white student uncomfortable, you can tell them all about the benevolent slaveholders.
You know, you mentioned when conservatives were making fun of the snowflakes. I mean, there were some pretty good stories out there about the colleges that were so concerned about their fragile students that if a controversial speaker came on campus, they would actually have like rooms. Remember where they would go and they would play with teddy bears and stuff. And they would, I mean, I'm not making this up. They would actually like have place safe spaces where you could go and you could draw on cardboard. I don't know what it was, but it was ridiculous. And now it's flipped around. You know, we have this debate.
We need therapy animals for everybody.
Therapy animals. So we do have a debate about what constitutes cancel culture, what constitutes infringement on, free speech. I mean, there are gray areas where holding people accountable for their words, is that an infringement on free speech, or is that just part of what accountability? But in your column, you quoted the head of this free speech group, Penn, saying that, you know, when you think about the hierarchy of infringements on free speech, there's no question legislative prohibitions on ideology are at the top of the list. I mean, that's kind of, there's a line there, right? When the law says you cannot, use these books or these ideas, that seems to be pretty clear stuff.
Right, because it's backed up by the power of the state. So it affects everybody across the state. And it's generally, I think, at least in half cases, it's backed up by some sort of a mandatory punishment. So, you know, not only do they, you know, slap your wrist and say you shouldn't do this, you could be fired or have some other penalty brought against you. I mean, between what began with the woke left and what has been finished with the snowflakes on the right, I mean, the ones who are suffering here are the kids. I mean, I thought the whole idea of an education is to be able to confront difficult issues that do divide people, and you got to figure out what the right answer is, or maybe there's some right on both sides. But the whole point is, you know, whatever happened to the Socratic argument as being the way that people learn. Now we must not be challenged in any way. I mean, all this is going to result in is just dumbing down America's children.
Well, and it already has. So when you wrote about the tip line in Virginia, I thought that I had not known about this before, the sort of the big helping of hypocrisy from Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, who apparently didn't mind if some kids got an anti-racist education as long as they were his own kids.
Yes.
So tell me about that story, because this is interesting, because he had taken this really uncompromising position that I'm going to protect all children from any kind of this propaganda. But it turns out that his own kids have a rather different educational standard.
Right. So all four of his kids have gone to what are called the cathedral school. So NCS, a National Cathedral School for Girls, is where his daughter went. And his three sons went to St. Albans, which is, you know, its brother school, also under the Episcopal Church. One of them moved on to Georgetown Prep, which I think was Brett Kavanaugh's school, right?
Yeah.
So somebody else has raised the point that he's still wearing a mask in school, even though Virginia kids have been told that they don't have to. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, Glenn Youngkin, it's all well and good to be for, you know, public school parents' rights. He exercised his public school parents' rights in Virginia to send his kids to elite private schools in Washington, where they received an education that, you know, I mean, I think it goes too far to say that, you know, public schools are teaching critical race theory. You know, they're not really, it's not really an anti-racism curriculum. It may be a more accurate history. But, you know, who is teaching an anti-racism curriculum that really could be, you know, considered similar to critical race theory? Well, that would be St. Albans and the National Cathedral School. And it's not just that he was a passive parent from 2016 through the end of 2019. He was on the board of governors of the National Cathedral School when they approved a strategic plan that basically was the basis for implementing this anti-racist curriculum. I mean, they've been very progressive on these matters, you know, going back for years. His office said, well, you know, the schools have changed over the years. And that is true over the years, but they haven't changed that dramatically since he left the board. That was pretty much already baked into the cake. So, I much prefer the parent Glenn Youngkin to the governor Glenn Youngkin, because he wants his kids to be in an environment where they're challenged to think and maybe be uncomfortable, maybe have to grapple with divisive issues. So it seems to me that he should extend the same benefits to public school kids in Virginia, but he's going to protect them from that.
So when we're talking about elite schools, these are the elite of the elite schools. You know, do you know how much they cost to go there? I mean,
they're north of 40,000, I think.
Very tony.
In fairness, that wasn't a big stretch for Youngkin. He was
no. He can afford it, and I of course am not a critic of private education, but it is interesting that these schools were quite forward-leaning, aggressive in pushing anti-racism. As you point out, that at St. Albans, they promote on their website books like White Fragility, Critical Race Theory, and Introduction, Ibram Kendi's Stamped from the Beginning, The Definitive History of Racist Ideas. Faculty are instructed to read Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. Right. I mean, this is full frontal CRT stuff.
Right. There's no argument that is CRT. No. That's the definition of it.
Yeah. When you're talking about Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, why it's so hard for white people to talk about racism. I mean, this is literally the CRT. And so this is Glenn Youngkin's kids' school. So what
it's not the first time you and I have encountered hypocrisy in this field, but it's a particularly delicious one since it's, you know, it's not that he was just, as I said, it's not just that he was a passive parent. He was right there in the mix as this stuff was being put into place.
So look, you and I could both spend all of our time just writing about hypocrisy. Sure. I was looking at two maps today, speaking of hypocrisy, and I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of gerrymandering and everything, but reading this passionate denunciation of how terrible gerrymandering was. And I was looking at one of the recent maps to come out of New York and another one coming out of Maryland. I know that people hate the both sides-ism argument, but guys, there's nothing new about gerrymandering. And literally, it is both political parties that are doing it. Now, again, it's maybe the fact that Democrats would like to pass federal legislation. Perhaps that is the crucial distinction. But the fact is that both these parties weaponize this and have been doing it for a very, very long time. Nobody's posing for holy pictures right now.
Yeah, I agree with you for the most part on that. I mean, you know, there are a couple of issues. One is there are more Republican-controlled states. So by definition, it's going to be happening more there. But the other, you know, we've heard this a little bit on the issue of, you know, super PACs and dark money. And, you know, you've seen stuff in the Times saying, oh, the Democrats, they're taking dark money and doing all this. But I agree. They shouldn't be taking dark money, but nobody, in my view, should be taking dark money. So the question is, if this is how the game is played, and the Supreme Court whether it's, you know, with Citizens United or whether it's blessing gerrymandering, if they say this is the law of the land, you're kind of a fool if you don't do it.
Sure. It's like being a football player and deciding that you're not going to be using the forward pass. I mean, you have to do it.
I object to it in principle.
Yeah. That's not the way we want to play the game. Well, that's the way we play the game.
So I guess the defense for the Democrats would be saying they would prefer to get rid of dark money, and they would prefer to get rid of gerrymandering, super PACs, the whole thing. But they're playing the cards they've been dealt. But I agree. It's ugly. It's ugly. Yeah, no matter who does it.
Well, it is ugly, and I have actually changed my position on gerrymandering over the years. I kind of shrugged for a while, and now I think it's hard not to recognize the degree to which it has really added to the toxicity and the tribalization of our politics, because there are so few competitive districts.
You know? Exactly. That's what had happened in this last round. I mean, I think Democrats were thinking, oh, they're going to take away all these seats from us. Republican states didn't really do that. What they've done is insulated their potentially vulnerable seats so that they will be immune from challenges now and, very likely for the next decade. So I think we're down to 25, seats that you could even, marginally say are, competitive out of 435. And the problem is, as you know, it's not just that they're not competitive between the parties. The only thing that matters is the primary.
Right.
And unfortunately, the ones who are winning primaries now are whoever can, shall we say, quote, Voltaire the best.
Well, all politics is primary politics now. I mean, that's what it's come down to, is that if you're a Republican,
it rewards the extreme. Yeah.
You don't have to worry about Democrats. You don't have to worry about, probably minorities. You don't have to worry about centrist voters. You just have to win that primary, and you win the primary by being the craziest son of a bitch on the ballot, as Thomas Massie famously once said.
Right. And when you say, all these guys are crazy. Well, not really. They're perfectly rational. they're doing what it takes to get elected and stay elected. They're playing the game properly.
Yeah. I mean, you see that, obviously, Ohio being the most, dramatic example, but I think you're seeing it played out everywhere in the country. And, when people say, well, when are Republicans going to speak out against the craziness? Well, it's when they're not looking over their shoulder, looking at a primary. Let's talk about the coup, what we've learned about the coup. It feels like there's this cascade of information, and I don't want to just blow past it, that you have the former president of the United States dangling pardons for insurrectionists, seditionists, rioters, with the implication that anyone that commits an act of political violence on his behalf going forward as well might be taken care of. I mean, it's so, part of the thing that's amazing is that if this was uncovered in tapes, secret tapes, it would be the biggest scandal ever. He just does it in public, in broad daylight. He just says, yes, you elect me and I will pardon all of you. What the hell?
You don't even have to elect him. You could just install him with violence and he will pardon you. You can skip the whole election thing. I mean, it's, long ago, it sort of lost its capacity to shock. And I suppose the shocking thing would be that Stephen Miller or somebody else hadn't drafted executive orders saying we must seize the voting machines. It's the environment is now that anything that comes out of that January 6th committee, a large chunk of the country will be conditioned to say, it's politics. I don't believe any of that. So we're in, this bizarre moment where you will care about it, I will care about it, and arguably, half the country will care about it, but the other half is just going to convince them that everything, all news is fake. But it has been an astonishing avalanche of revelations.
Well, let me bounce this off of you, because we have spent the last 6 years going, oh my God, that's incredible, or maybe this is the turning point, or this is the breaking point, and it never is. But the craziness has been ramping up. Trump clearly is running for office. He has no other agenda really other than to relitigate his own, gripes. He's crazier and more reckless all the time. there are these voices out there. You have Larry Hogan out there saying that he might run for president. You have Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, of all places, saying he shouldn't be allowed back in office. I mean, they're very much outliers. And then there are some people writing columns, you know, looking at the polls and, you know, if you squint the right way, does it look like he's maybe losing his grip on the party? I guess how much of that is wish casting, and how much of that is maybe that there is kind of a Trump fatigue out there? What do you think?
Here's how I'd look at it is there may or may not be a Trump fatigue, but it's almost beside the point because it's Trumpism. There doesn't appear to be any fatigue there. No. If you look at DeSantis, you know, or even if you look at Youngkin, I mean, Trump himself, I mean, arguably would be less of a threat because he's more bumbling than a DeSantis. I mean, you know, Trump did not succeed with some of his worst instincts simply because of incompetence. So the fact that, you know, there are tip lines in Virginia to report on your teachers coming from this, you know, mainstream, what I think previously would have been viewed as a moderate a businessman. I mean, that to me is more alarming than, you know, the perfectly, you know, to be expected pronouncements out of Trump about pardoning the violent. It seems to me that it's just taken over. So yeah, we, you know, for 5-6 years, we thinking this would finally be the moment, but I think it's pretty obvious that that moment is not going to come. There's no critical mass left to make that moment happen.
No, I agree with that take. I have confessed that maybe I don't have the clearest view of this because I still suffer from PTSD, and so we'll never underestimate the craziness or indulge in irrational hopes and expectations. But you know, even when you look at these polls, and so he may be under 50%, but he's still at 40%. Look, you need an overt act to take him down. Tim Miller had a great piece yesterday. Look, at some point, some Republicans in key positions are going to have to be willing to take some political pain to be able to push back, to do something about it. And I don't know that they're willing to commit those overt acts to stop him. But you raise an interesting question here, which I don't think I've thought through completely. Are you feeling right now that in some ways, well, I think you just said this, that in some ways a more competent Trumpist is actually scarier than the real thing? Than Trump himself, because Trump, we know, is kind of bumbling and incompetent and crazy and known quantity. So are you saying that the next generation might be worse than him?
I think so. I mean, you know, and because Trump is you know, vulgar and sort of a buffoon, so some people who might even like some of the more authoritarian instincts just don't like the mannerisms. But you know, think about somebody like DeSantis, who I think is much smarter than Donald Trump is. He's setting up, or you know, proposing to set up this special police force reporting only to him, that will be, you know, have free rein, it sounds like, to rove around polling places, you know, and, you know, just looking for some, you know, problems or irregularities. But, you know, obviously anybody looking at this would know that that's all about voter intimidation. So I think something like that is more dangerous. I think, you know, that there's somebody who potentially, you know, could have the charisma of Trump, but sort of the brains of Stephen Miller. I think that's much more. I mean, Trump is a known commodity, and there's, you know, there's built-in opposition to him by, you know, arguably a majority of the American public. So I don't want to be out here saying, boy, I really hope Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, but.
Well, the other point is, leaving aside the personalities, I mean, the forces that have been unleashed, you know, it is like they thought it was a controlled burn, and now it's turned into this massive conflagration that no individual can actually control anymore. And it's taking on bizarre different forms. And I'm not sure that even Trump, Trump himself knows that he can't get too far out ahead of that of, you know, his own people or any other political figure out there. And you've seen this on, you know, issue after issue. So the unleashing of what, for lack of a better term, we could call Trumpism, we may need to come up with some different term for that at some point. I think that's become more virulent, and he disappears from the political scene tomorrow, and that does not go away. We don't have a return to normalcy. Again, this feels like an old story, but I mean, your thoughts, Susan Collins, who's voted once in the second impeachment, you know, she's not up for another 6 years. She's asked on Sunday morning television, you know, would you close the door to, you know, supporting him? She can't answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if Susan Collins, I mean, that just seems to me to be such a canary in the coal mine. If Susan Collins, who is moderate and reasonable and always concerned about everything, who's actually voted to convict him, if even she can't say that the morning after he dangles pardons, then right.
And I had that same sense after Lamar Alexander announced his retirement. Like, well, what's he got to lose? I mean, you know Lamar Alexander. He can't possibly be on board with this. my feeling is that because this is where even the country club Republican base has gone, where the Chamber of Commerce base has gone, I think these individual figures, it's not really even primarily political blowback. I think it's social blowback. You know, it would be like the approbation of your peers. You know, they see how Jeff Flake became a pariah. They see Liz Cheney and Kinzinger, and they don't want that to happen to them. Not just from their colleagues in Congress, but from their friends and supporters at home. I mean, that's what I'm guessing is happening.
No, I don't think you should underestimate that at all. Now, speaking of Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, the RNC is going to be taking up a resolution, apparently being pushed by Trump ally David Bossie, to expel them from the Republican Party, to formally call on the House conference to expel them. And that's going to be up at the RNC committee. My level of surprise, if that passed, would be 2 on a scale of 1 to 100.
I haven't investigated this yet, but when I saw this, I'm thinking, you know, who has that weapon been used against in history? I mean, was it used against McCarthy? He was censured. Mm-hmm. Who else has been deserving of this, political death penalty in history? I think it might be worth.
And the obsession with it. It's not just that you can denounce them or criticize them. You have to keep upping the ante. You have to keep driving them out, making it very clear that we're going to excommunicate you. And again, I know this is getting old, but I just find it so ironic that the explanation we heard from all the cool kids was, Liz Cheney needed to be removed from leadership because she just wouldn't move on. She just kept talking about that election, and we need to move on and be forward facing. And then you look at everything that's happened now. Donald Trump will absolutely not let them move on. He is not moving on, people.
No, we're not moving on. Although, the truth is, even expulsion by the RNC would be pretty benign compared to what Newt Gingrich has proposed. He wants to see them locked up.
What is with Newt Gingrich? What's your take? I mean, you've watched him for years.
I have. I've got a book coming out in August on starting with the Republican Revolution of Gingrich's in 94. I'm obviously not the first to say this, but I think he paved the way for a lot of what we're seeing today. But he quickly embraced Trump early on, and look, I mean, he's no idiot. He sees where the party is, and he wants to be out leading that parade rather than trying to turn it into another direction. So, it's his way of staying relevant. And, he got to be husband of the ambassador to the Holy See. So he must be doing something right.
Yeah. Well, Newt Gingrich is one of those figures. I look back on, what happened, and you think of, with Sarah Palin being an inflection point, Newt Gingrich being an inflection point, all of these things. And yet it's hard to have predicted at the time that it was going to end up this particular way. But the fact that he not only suggests expelling them, but throwing them in prison, it's just amazing. I wanted to double back on this. Since we were talking about elections and lying about elections, obviously the Democrats are not going to get their voting rights bills through.
Yes. But that's also a level two on the surprise scale of 100.
Right. But there is a lot of speculation about this bipartisan gang working on fixing the Electoral Count Act. Mm-hmm. They have 9 Republicans. They don't have 10 yet. Mm-hmm. But they are working on, you know, fixing that bill, which in a rational world would be the lowest of lowest hanging fruit. Fix that screwed up piece of legislation. What do you think? Politico was saying that the Biden White House is keeping hands off, that they are completely AWOL. They don't want to have anything to do with it. A lot of Democrats are worried that somehow this is a bipartisan trap. Mm-hmm. But if they can't fix the Electoral Count Act, I mean, really.
Well, I mean, I could see the standoffishness at first because they didn't want it as an excuse not to do anything else. But I think it's pretty clear that, you know, that ship has sailed. So, yeah, it's a very minor fix to prevent an exact repeat of what happened last time, which wouldn't stop a similar thing from happening in any number of other ways. But sure, why not? It's better than not doing anything.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty clear. So give me your take on Joe Biden right now. We're now more than a year into his presidency. I think he started off with a lot of projected optimism about mm-hmm. what kind of a president he would be, what kind of agenda he would have. And yet here we are. And of course, the polls and the conventional wisdom kind of line up that he's in a world of hurt.
Yeah, I think he is. I think anybody would have been. And, you know, Charlie, when you look at, you know, you could step back and say, hey, you know, we just had the strongest economic growth since, you know, Morning in America, 1984. And yeah, inflation is higher than it was then, but not, you know, not hugely so. But the mood of the nation is dramatically different. And, you know, of course, some of that's this, you know, never-ending pandemic. But I also, I just think that the political culture that has been created means there's a ceiling for Biden or for anybody else. It's, you know, going to be somewhere around 50%, low 50s in approval. There's probably a floor of 30%, you know, somebody on either side. And then, you know, it's sort of approval will be the few sort of persuadable people in the middle. But look, he gets terrible press. He has been ineffective. I don't think that's a statement on Biden. I think it's a statement that everything is broken. I do not suppose that if he started from the very beginning saying, let me just sit down with Mitch McConnell and see what we can get done, that he'd be sitting on any accomplishment that he's not sitting on now.
So are you saying that no one can be a success, that we were just in an era now where we're just not going to ever have a successful president or not ever, but that no one could succeed in this environment?
That's my sense. You know, certainly nobody's going to be popular the way even, you know, a George W. Bush was, or, you know, even an Obama was early. Yeah, briefly. Yeah. Right. I mean, they've all been brief, but, think about, you know, Bill Clinton, you know, during impeachment, he had very low favorability ratings, but he had very high job approval ratings because people reacted to the economy. You know, now people react to the economy based on the party you're in. And, you know, we have an election that changes and everybody completely changes their view of the economy. And, you know, you can see it now. And, you know, if you look at actual spending, you know, purchasing, people are feeling pretty good if you look at it in the aggregate. But if you ask people how things are, they say it's terrible. So
you're
I think
a bad
that's,
mood.
That's a reaction to the culture.
This is the culture, and I'm going to call up a tweet that I wanted to get your reaction to.
Voltaire, I don't want
no,
to
No, it's not. It's not. It's
it's Mark Twain.
Or allegedly Voltaire, yes. Nate Cohn tweeted out a couple of hours ago, deservedly or not, the public lost confidence in the Biden administration's competence and leadership in August. The country has had an adrift and hopeless feel since then, with no sense of direction back to normalcy, et cetera. And that's what's holding back economic confidence. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I mean, obviously we have the pandemic, we have inflation, we have other issues, but it did feel that the fiasco in Afghanistan broke something and we never came back from that.
I think, well, certainly that was a fiasco. I don't dispute that at all. I don't think Americans are thinking at all about Afghanistan. Now, maybe it left them with a sense of bumbling, but that was also the Delta wave, which we'd never quite got out of, and then the Omicron wave. So I think it was, I think the honeymoon that Biden enjoyed was when it looked like, hey, we're getting out of this pandemic. So I think that's the largest piece that has dragged it down, you know, as opposed to an economic one, although it obviously has an economic effect as well. But that's why I think regardless of who was in office was going to be pretty much trashed by that series of events. Now, maybe because he's been so low for so long, he can't recover even if the pandemic goes away. I mean, that remains to be seen. But I mean, you know, even if, you know, inflation were running at 1.5% and we had, you know, annual GDP growth of 5%, if you are watching Fox News, you are certainly not going to think the economy is in good shape.
No, and they're not going to emphasize that, no.
Yeah, so I don't really see how that would, I think it's almost impervious to whatever's happening in the economy.
It is interesting, and you've written about this before, you know, how effective Fox can be in, you know, putting forth a negative, you know, a negative narrative about, you know, anything. You know, for example, the pounding on Joe Biden for, you know, wanting to, you know, use the FBI to investigate parents and all of this, that he was, you know, that all of that. But also the way that they have really weaponized his age. And this has been something they've just pounded and pounded. And I spent a little bit of time in conservative media and how that is sort of the background noise to everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, but when you start to see weakness, it, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? They have created this template so that every time he stumbles that you might not have noticed before, suddenly right. It's like, okay, this is what I've been hearing. You know, it plays to this. And they have really pounded this.
And it works. I mean, you're seeing it. I mean, I see it in my emails, and you see it not just on the right now, but on, you know, independent voters, and I think even Democratic voters are worried about his age. And yeah, I mean, you can see exactly how it happens. The guy, as you know, has a stutter, and you can see when he is having trouble with a word, and he sort of shuts his eyes and blinks. He's trying to pronounce the word. And those of us who've watched Joe Biden in, you know, the 80s and 90s and aughts know that this is the exact same guy we were watching then, who would, you know, put his foot in his mouth repeatedly and say all kinds of ill-advised things. So, but yes, now it's been put through the lens of being a result of his age. Now, I think it's entirely possible that, you know, he's not... I'm in my 50s and I'm not as sharp as I was. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he's not as sharp as he once was. But like, he held a news conference for an hour and three quarters.
Yeah.
Okay, well, he kind of gave away Ukraine for a minute there.
It was a bad moment there.
But just for a brief minute. But I mean, you know, somebody who is in the grips of dementia could not get through an hour and three quarter news conference.
No, I agree with Will Salatin on this. I don't think that he has dementia. I don't think he's losing mental, but you know, he's slowing down in his ability to express himself. And again, anyone who reaches a certain age recognizes that. Doesn't mean he's not going to make the right decisions or he doesn't understand the issues, but it's a PR problem. So since we started off with Thomas Massey tweeting,
mm-hmm.
So Massey tweets about Voltaire. He's quoting the Nazi pedophile instead. And then he continues, of course, tweeting because he wants that sweet, sweet dopamine hit of Twitter likes. Mm-hmm. And just yesterday he retweeted Matt Gaetz, who tweeted, "Thus begins another week of the Silver Alert presidency." So you have congressmen tweeting and then retweeting sort of snide Silver Alert presidency jokes. So we see where this goes. And
there's an obvious joke to be made when you said that he tweeted a pedophile and then he tweeted Matt Gaetz, but I'm not going there.
We wouldn't want to do that because
we wouldn't want
to prejudge. Maybe it's just he figures, okay, so this guy, maybe a neo-Nazi arrested for child pornography, But Matt Gaetz, she was 17. I don't know.
It's fine.
We could have gone on for another 4 hours here, but I really appreciate you coming back on the podcast. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it greatly. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.